guest from general nonfiction will start, followed by entries from anthology, and then creative nonfiction, and finally history. Oh, thank you. I just don't want to buzz. Okay. Thanks. We'll move quickly, keeping everyone to their time limits. And there are copies of all the finalist books available for purchase. And we hope you'll join us for the book signing and enjoy the book bar's great snacks and drinks during and after the reading, including they have a $5 wordsmith sangria special for tonight. And Colorado Humanities also sprung for a meat and cheese plate. There'll be Q&A after each author reads, and we'll have another chance for questions at the end. So, our first reader tonight is Michael Kodas, who will be reading from his nonfiction book, Megafire, The Race to Extinguish a Deadly Epidemic of Flame. Michael's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and the deputy director of the Center for the for Environmental Journalism at the University of Colorado Boulder. Megafire was named one of the 20 best nonfiction books of 2017 by Amazon. And in 2008, Michael wrote High Crimes, The Fate of Everest in the Age of Greed, which was named best nonfiction in USA Book, USA Book News National Best Book Awards. His work has been featured in newspapers, magazines, and broadcast outlets around the world. In Megafire, a world-renowned journalist and forest fire expert travels to the most dangerous and remote wilderness, as well as to the backyards of people faced with these environmental disasters, to look at the heart of the phenomenon and witness firsthand the heroic efforts of the firefighters and scientists to stop it, or at least tame the deadly flames. Megafire describes the profound impact of these fires around the earth and will change the way we think about the environment and the essential precariousness of our world. Michael, I turn it over to you.
Thank you. So believe it or not, this is the first time I've actually read from my book in front of people. I have a background in photojournalism, and I always do multimedia shows, which allow me to hide behind photographs and video and such, and not show my weak reading skills. So yeah, be kind about that. I'm going to start with basically something very close to the start of the book. I follow about a century of policy decisions and disasters and things that we've done as a nation that led to the largest loss of professional wildland firefighter life in the nation's history, which was in 2013 in Arizona. And this scene is the firefighters who went to retrieve the bodies of the 19 Granite Mountain hotshots who perished in that incident. Two of the firefighters who came to retrieve the hotshots' bodies draped the orange bags with American flags. Others walked among them whispering prayers or silent goodbyes. Then the team regrouped and rotated through the tasks they'd volunteered for. Eight split into an honor guard leading to the back of a pickup, four on either side. The remaining four lifted a bag by its corners and carried it to the truck. As they approached, the other firefighters snapped to a salute. Once a bag was secured in the truck's bed, the honor guard stood at ease, the men wiped their eyes, and the teams rotated. The bags were marked by numbers rather than names, as many of the bodies inside them were burned beyond recognition. The members of the honor guard were thankful they wouldn't know which of their friends they were carrying until the investigators' reports were released 2 months later. The radio the paramedic had heard the night before continued transmitting voices that repeatedly startled the crew into hopeful glances toward the deployment zone. Once the last corpse was loaded, Darrell Willis opened the Bible he carried in his truck to Psalm 23. A former chief of the Prescott Fire Department, Willis had come out of retirement to take on the task of protecting the city from forest fires as the department's wildland division chief. Under his leadership, the Granite Mountain Hotshots had formed, a crew of 20 elite forest firefighters that in 2013 was the only one of 109 hotshot crews in the country to be part of a city fire department. Only one member of his crew was still alive when Willis read the psalm in the charred canyon. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil. Danny Parker, a firefighter with the Chino Valley Department northeast of Prescott, fell to his knees as Willis read. I'm a broken man, he said later, just weak and broken and humble. Danny asked if he could pray with the men. His voice quivered and cracked, and the other firefighters wondered how he could possibly deliver even a short invocation, given that he had lost more than anyone else at the scene. When he was a child in Prescott, Danny sat on his back porch with his family, watching the 1972 battle fire as it licked over the mountains where they often hunted and picked apples. It grew into the largest blaze in Arizona history to that day. He saw the Castle Fire break that record 7 years later, and the Dude Fire that grew nearly as big and killed 6 firefighters near Payson in 1990. After stints in the U.S. Navy and working construction, he joined the Chino Valley Fire Department. Danny and his wife raised 4 children, but his son Wade followed closest in his footsteps. A photo of Wade as a child showed him wearing a firefighting costume and hosing down a small bonfire in the family's backyard. For his school science fair, he built a model demonstrating the chimney effect on a house fire. Wade excelled at every sport he tried, but baseball and bow hunting were his passions. Danny made all of his children's bows and gave Wade his first one when the boy was 3 years old, then made him others as he grew bigger and stronger. The weapons are works of art, made of wood such as bird's eye maple, African wangy, and Brazilian yellow heart, and adorned with elk horn bow tips. Father and son would text each other photos of the tight patterns of their arrows on targets. Danny also coached several of his son's baseball teams and would get flack from family and friends for not highlighting Wade's talents more, not that his son needed it. A grand slam that Wade hit in high school helped him secure a baseball scholarship, but his classic ball player's good looks and polite demeanor, sandy brown hair, wide boys of summer smile, and Sunday school manners probably didn't hurt. We always thought he'd be famous for getting to the big leagues, his older sister Amber said at a church service 10 years after Danny Parker's prayer in the burn zone. But after a year in college, Wade gave up his scholarship and moved back to the family home. He loved baseball, but he said he realized it was time to become a man, Danny said. He wanted to come home, pursue becoming a firefighter, get married, and have a family. Danny advised him to get a job on a Type 2 hand crew, the common entry into the world of fighting forest fires. But no, he wanted to be a hotshot, Danny said. Nobody was surprised when Wade was hired onto Prescott's elite Granite Mountain Interagency Hotshot Crew, or when he was named the crew's Rookie of the Year in 2012. Father and son often hugged as they left their house for their respective firehouses, then chatted about their work days when they were back at home. Never lose your respect for the fire, Danny told his son. That's when bad things happen. The power of the forces on this earth, they don't care who you are. When they hunted together, Danny would point out fire hazards to his son, such as ravines that could trap a firefighter in a natural chimney, or clouds on the horizon that signaled weather that could turn a fire or blow it up. Thunder could make rutting elk bugle and warned of new fires ignited by lightning. Wade, like his father, worked on the side as a hunting guide and developed a good eye for vegetation and habitat. He recognized that fire was just as often a benefit to the forests where he worked as it was a hazard. He told his father about areas he'd like to go back to with a bow when he didn't have to be there carrying a chainsaw. He didn't talk about the fires hardly ever. He talked about how beautiful the mountains were, Danny said, about this waterfall and how they bathed under it because they hadn't had a shower in a long time. A week before the Yarnell Hill fire, the Granite Mountain Hotshots worked on the Dosey Fire, a 6,700-acre blaze just outside Prescott, exactly the kind of threat to the city the unit had been formed to stand up against. They got something of a hero's welcome because afterward, for helping to protect more than 400 homes that the fire threatened, and for saving the nation's second-largest alligator juniper tree, which was located on Granite Mountain. But much of their namesake peak had burned, and Wade confided to his father that the crew was as humbled as they were proud. They got teased for letting their mountain burn, Danny said. Some would see the scorching of the mountain the hotshots were named after as an omen of what happened to them just weeks later. But before that, Danny saw something more concrete to worry about in the Dosey Fire. He was working outside on a day off from firefighting when he noticed a wisp of smoke over the mountain. Just a few hours later, the Dosey Fire was racing toward homes in the Williamson Valley. From 50 to 5,000 acres in just 3 or 4 hours, its rate of speed was absolutely incredible, Danny said. It was like a foretelling of what the fire behavior was going to be like. In the 25 years that Danny had been fighting fires, he'd noticed a change. He told his son about it. If you go back 30 years and watch bull riding, there were a few bulls that bucked incredibly well, he said. Then they started to breed these bulls to buck. Now every bull that comes out of the bucking chutes is like the better ones from 30 years ago. The same goes those with fires. We've always had volatile fires during volatile times, but now almost all of them are that volatile. Danny was happy that Wade was working with men who he knew and respected, and more important, that he knew respected fire. Eric Marsh, the superintendent of the crew, had been eating, sleeping, and dreaming wildfire for decades. He and his wife at the time had started the Arizona Wildfire Academy in their mobile home and turned it into one of the largest and most respected schools for forest firefighters in the country. Jesse Steed, the captain of the crew, was a former gunner in the U.S. Marine Corps who had no problem hugging his men, telling them that he loved them, and then leading them through workouts that left them puking along the trail. Wade patterned his work after some of the previous rookies of the year, Andrew Ashcraft and Robert Caldwell, both family men. A few weeks before the Arnell Hill fire, he was promoted to Sawyer, responsible for running a chainsaw, and proved as skilled with that as he was with a bow or a baseball bat. Danny was also pleased that his son's fire crew fit so well with Wade's reverence of family and God. When his younger brother dreamed of being a bull rider in rodeos, turned 18, Wade showed up with several of his crewmates and their girlfriends at the small restaurant where the family was celebrating, bearing the gift of a $500 pair of chaps. In 2012, while visiting Disneyland, he proposed to Alicia Owens, his girlfriend since he was 16. Their wedding was scheduled for October 2013. Wade was in his second season with Granite Mountain when the summer of 2013 exploded with fire. Chris Hunter, a high school teacher he stayed in touch with, sent him a worried note. He texted a picture of himself on fire. "Miss Hunter," he wrote, "I'm a hotshot. I'm good." Danny Parker was the first to volunteer to retrieve the bodies of his son and the rest of the Granite Mountain hotshots, the only family member of the fallen firefighters to join the recovery team. At the site where the hotshots made their final stand by lying on the ground, he finished his prayer and somehow rose to his feet. "All I could do was thank him for 22 years," he told me. Then someone looked up at the mountain and pointed at two cracks forming a cross in the face of a huge granite boulder. "All 19 of those boys were at the foot of the cross," he said. As he left the scene, the recovery team placed a more humble marker on the site, a black T-shirt with a Granite Mountain Hotshots logo, which they hung on the lone surviving cactus. Danny knew that each of the men who perished on Yarnell Hill had a story as compelling as his son's. Every one of them was loved in the tight-knit clan that grew up around Arizona's oldest fire department. Each of them had his own family now quaking with grief. And Danny also knew that across the country and around the world, other communities were facing mass fatalities and destruction of hundreds of homes in wildfires. In the following months, Danny would learn that Wade was the closest of the hotshots to the cross and the stone, and that he had carried the bag with his son's remains. He took some comfort in that knowledge. But the most urgent question he and other firefighters around the nation were struggling with was left unanswered by the debris strewn at the deployment site and the investigations that followed the fire. An hour before they crawled under their fire shelters, the Granite Mountain hotshots were standing in what firefighters called the black, where most of the vegetation had already been burned away, creating a haven from the fire. They could see the inferno exploding below them, yet they descended into a box canyon that any firefighter would recognize as a death trap, a natural chimney so choked with brush they had to hack their way through it, and so oily it burned as if soaked in gasoline. What led Wade Parker and his crew to leave the safety zone where they could easily have survived the fire they could see boiling below them and descend into the canyon where they were most vulnerable to it? The answer to that question lies as much in the century of policy decisions and the decade-long explosion of fires that led up to the disaster as it does in the decision the hotshots made in the minutes before their deaths. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Michael. And does anyone have a question for Michael? Any questions?
Heckles? Fruit to throw? Yeah.
Well, you mentioned that you started as a photojournalist, but now you're writing very word-centric, not at least strong writing. So how did you make that
I had a really great gig for a number of years with a newspaper on the East Coast where once a year we would do what they called adventure journalism and was really, to me, environmental journalism where you used adventure to kind of sugarcoat it. For instance, you know, one year I circumnavigated Long Island Sound in a sea kayak to do a bunch of stories on marine issues, knowing that most readers didn't care about the issues I cared about, but they would actually pick up the newspaper every week to see if I'd managed to drown my myself, and that I might get a chance to teach them something if I presented things right. And one project that I did as fires were becoming a really big problem, this is at the time of the Hayman fire, was train and work as a Forest Service firefighter here in Colorado and in Wyoming to kind of give a sense of how big the problem was getting, how many people were being drawn into it. On a lot of those stories, there was really only the opportunity to get one journalist on the scene. And I'd always written stuff to go with my photos, but at that point I kind of began writing and shooting my own projects. And I still have a ton of photography of wildfire that I've done while reporting this story. So I guess I see myself more as a storyteller that works with a variety of things, photographs, video, and writing. Writing is the one that takes me the longest, so maybe that's why I'm best known for it. Anybody else?
Any questions? There will be a chance at the end, but I want to give you an opportunity right now.
Yeah, if you'd like to take some time to concoct a really difficult question, which is what I would do, yeah. Then you can harass me at the end. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mike.
Our next reader is the first person in the anthology category, Stephanie Geschwind, who will read from her book, Beautiful Flesh, A Body of Essays. Stephanie is the editor of Colorado Review and the director of the Center for Literary Publishing at Colorado State University. She edited the anthology Man in the Moon Essays on Fathers and Fatherhood and is the series editor for the Colorado Prize for Poetry and co-editor with Donald Revelle of the Mountain West Poetry Series. She's worked in the publishing industry for more than 20 years. Beautiful Flesh gathers 18 essays on the body, building on a multi-gender, multi-ethnic literary body with essays on the belly, brain, bones, blood, ears, eyes, hair, hands, heart, lungs, nose, ovaries, pancreas, sinus, skin, spine, and teeth. I probably left one out. These essays showcase the many forms of the genre: personal, memoir, lyric, braided, and so on. So I turn it over now to Stephanie.
Thank you, everyone, for coming tonight. I'm really amazed at how many people showed up for this event. It's wonderful. And thank you to Bess for organizing this and Shell for emceeing. I'm going to read just two very short pieces. I'll read the introduction, since it's the only thing in the anthology that I actually wrote. And I'll read a very short essay at the end, or that's at the end of the anthology. It's the essay on feet. I organized all of the essays sort of going down the body. So we start off with hair, and then we end up, you know, brain, and then we work all the way down to feet. So I'll read that last one. In the introduction, we'll just talk a little bit about why I put this together. In the beginning, heart and bone. Still exhilarated by the thrill of putting together my first nonfiction anthology, Man in the Moon, Essays on Fathers and Fatherhood, I began to look for another project. It didn't take long to find the inspiration. In Colorado Review, the literary magazine I edit with my colleagues and several amazing graduate students at Colorado State University, we recently published Matthew Ferrance's Mos Teutonicus, titled for the ancient practice of removing flesh from bones in order to transport a body long distance, and Catherine Sandifer's Shock to the Heart, or A Primer on the Practical Applications of Electricity, on her experience of living with an internal cardiac defibrillator. And there it was, an anthology of essays on the body. It would embrace the body's whole, its parts, its form, its function, its spirit, its nature, exploring through many voices a variety of concerns and obsessions in memoir, personal essay, and lyric essay, inviting a range of traditional and experimental approaches. I put out the call to the creative nonfiction community, and the essays began to come in. Soon I had eyes, and then a nose, and then blood. And here, the focus changed ever so slightly. With an oblique nod to Victor Frankenstein, I decided to build a body out of essays. So collected here are 20 essays, each taking on a different anatomical part, combining to create a body of neither one gender nor one ethnicity, neither one ability nor one shape. It is a body that celebrates and grieves, remembers and forgets, injures and heals, loves and laments itself. Between a full head of hair rendered patchy by radiation and a pair of feet that run from a troubled marriage, I come to know pain and possibility, compassion and beauty, a virus that wreaks havoc with a man's ability to think, a strange design of sinuses, a woman's tentative love for her teeth, another's urge to bite the flesh from her fingers, the way a father can't resist nibbling his sweet daughter's ear, and another man's reasons for undergoing a vasectomy. Assembled here, there's also blood and breath, skin and spine, knees, ovaries, and belly, and of course, a pancreas, once very long ago called the calicreas, or beautiful flesh. Every anthologist assembles a body of some kind. This one is, of course, a human body. But in the gathering and arranging, it wasn't Frankenstein's voice I heard. From the start, beginning with those first two essays, it was Paul Simon's. You take two bodies, or 20, and you twirl them into one, their hearts and their bones, and they won't come undone. Hearts and bones, indeed. And now I'll read from Angela Pelster's essay on the feet called Once Then. Once I washed his feet, he washed mine, because once, they told us, Christ took off his coat and tied a towel around his waist and knelt, cradled the disciples' cracked heels in his hands like baby birds, and cleaned the rough and ticklish places together. Go and do likewise, we were told. So I took his feet in my hands and washed them clean, wanting grace, or God, or miracle, or show, all of it. And he did the same with mine. Those nights we slept soul to soul, grounded on the other. Once, one night in a backyard pool, we swam together and everything touched, every limb found heat, ecstasy shushed, quiet by the other in the dark. And my foot was sliced deep with his nail. I bled into the cold water, hurt and laughing, showed him later for years the scar over the smooth blue veins that he had given me. Once, those first days, we held her new, washed her in a plastic tub on the kitchen table, cleaned the dried blood from her ears, the folds of her skin along her neck, the space between each finger. She wailed when I took her toes in my teeth, nibbled the nails to keep her safe from scratches. Pale limbs flailed, heart blind to any kindness but my depth. But oh, her rounded soles, so mint condition. That foot I awed, that one that had pushed inside me nights while I grew her. Then those nights, time circled while I waited, until late black, nearly morning, he crept back in, sun almost rising, the house not lit. I listened as he went down the stairs into the basement. I do not know why. He took to pissing in the floor drain, all that vodka down the drain, the secret bottle stashed in the rafters, feet soaked legs as he topped the stairs, a wet trail below, and me at the kitchen table waiting, a broken tree about to topple, limbs bent, eyes akimbo, the rustle of baby in her crib down the hall, the click of a light flicked on as we blinked under it. This, some inquisition. This, some role I did not know how to play. Soon I would sit beside him on the couch. He would confess to the women like groceries, a list, here and here, with her and her. I listened, traced my finger along the smooth skin of his arm, one smooth place, so smooth, so unable to wake to it. I broke my toe. His broke too. And I kicked at him, he said. He said I kicked him and broke his toe. when my hands flew at the things he had done, and he picked me up and slammed me into the new white fridge to stop my wild arms and left his purple fingerprints on me. And toes broke, snap, snap, like the other things. But first there was this night, when he stood in the kitchen and swayed, when my hands moved to their theology, to pull a chair from the table, fill a bucket with water, and kneel to wash. His face sweated shame, mine twitched its grasping. Bodies, only flesh, my feet, already racing, hurtling toward the dark and the done and the breaking. There was no stopping it, though I would not know it then, or the why of it, any of it, ever. Yet still, 12 years into after, nothing to say of it but this. Dear humans, both, on the edge of your making, chin up, it will not cease to hurt. It will one day cease to matter. Thank you.
Does anyone have a question for Stephanie? We can. Oh, here's someone.
Yeah. Were you interested in or involved with medical?
No, I don't play a doctor on TV. No, it really was. There's something so rewarding about putting an anthology together, and I edit a magazine, and so I'm always putting, you know, stories and essays and poems together. But with a magazine, you get what you get, and you publish the stuff that you think is really great, of course. But it's never. You know, like a theme. It just, unless you put out a call for themed issues, and I find that very difficult. But that's what's so wonderful about doing an anthology is you can start to think about, oh, there's, you know, all these essays about animals or fathers or body parts, and wouldn't these look really great together? Sometimes I think about it as like making a quilt, you know, deciding that, oh, don't all these blue fabrics look really great together? And if only I had a vehicle, oh, I could make an anthology. And so that's why. And it really did start off with, I want to do another one. What should I do it about? And realizing, well, I had just published in our magazine two essays, one on the heart and one on bones. And that seemed like a good beginning. And then I had to go out and find the others. And that was a little harder than I thought it was going to be. It took about almost 2 years to put this together.
Any other questions?
Okay.
With the essays you received, is there any characteristic or a couple of features that all of these essayists shared that kind of leapt out at you where you may not have gone in thinking, oh, I expect to see this, but by the end of your anthologizing, you thought, oh, that's very interesting?
So the question was there anything that I kind of discovered at the end that maybe I wasn't looking for at the beginning? What did these essays all have in common? Or many of them have in common? So what I was really hoping for was not to end up, well, what ended up happening is a lot of them were based in sickness and injury, and I realized, well, that's when people write about their bodies. You know, you don't write about your nose because it works perfectly well and you happen to love it. You write about your nose because it's giving you problems. But what I was trying to avoid, this is not exactly answering your question, but what I was trying to avoid was straight narratives of this happened and then this happened and then I had to have this surgery and this is how I recovered. I didn't want that. I wanted people to create something that was surprising with their you know, in some ways a meditation on their body part. So to tell us what happened, but to have the personal, but create a kind of a universal as well. And it would be nice if they weren't all the same form. So this one is very lyric. It reads almost like poetry. The narrative is a little oblique. There are other essays in the anthology that are a lot more narrative and you know exactly what's happening. So I guess I was surprised in some ways how very differently so many people approached you know, their particular body part that they were writing about. So, yeah. Anything else? Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Next, Mario Acevedo and Joshua Viola will read from their anthology, Blood Business, Crime Stories from This World and Beyond. Mario is the author of the Felix Gomez series, 5 vampire novels, a graphic novel, some short fiction, and numerous ghostwritten books. He lives and drinks in Denver, he reports. Joshua is an author, artist, and former video games developer, in addition to creating a transmedia franchise around the Bane of Yodo. Honored with more than a dozen awards. He's the author of Black Star, a tie-in novel based on the discography of Cell Dweller. His debut horror anthology, Nightmares Unhinged, was a Denver Post number one bestseller. He lives in Denver, where he is the chief editor and owner of Hex Publishers. About this book, The Grift, The Scam, A Double Cross, Blackmail and Burglary, Murder and Larceny. Blood Business tracks the underbelly of human nature through the muck of our lesser angels in 27 crime stories set in this world and beyond. I'll turn it over to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. So I'm going to speak just briefly before I hand it over to Mario, but my name is Josh Viola, co-editor of Blood Business, and I wanted to thank Book Bar and Colorado Humanities for the honor. I appreciate everything, and the wine is fantastic. So I just wanted to say last year my anthology Cyberworld was nominee for the Colorado Book Award, as was Mario's anthology Found. So and Mario won, and very happy for him. And I remember that night when I won, that saying, keep your friends close and keep your enemies even closer. So now we've worked together on Blood Business, and it's a fantastic book. I'm very proud. We're here as the editors representing the authors, and we have a number in the audience. There's Sean Eads, Warren Hammond, Angie Hodapp, Dean Wyant, and I hope I didn't miss anybody. But we asked Mark Stevens to read from his story, Bone on Wood, tonight. So I'm going to hand it off to Mario to speak, and thank you very much.
Well, we need a more enthusiastic thanks to the Colorado Humanities, the Center for the Book, and the Book Bars. On the count of three, you're all going to give a loud and thunderous hoorah, all right? 1, 2, 3, hoorah! There you go. It's either that or do push-ups, okay? So before we go, there's a commercial announcement that I need to make, is that Hex Publishers has a book, Denver Moon, written by Josh and Warren Hammond, and on June 1st, they're having a special book launch reading at the Alamo Theater at Souls Lake. It's at 8 p.m., and they also have a special beer that night, the Red Fever Blood Orange IPA. All right, so make sure you show up there. Otherwise, we're going to track you down and give you some blood business of our own. So the reader tonight is going to be Mark Stevens. Now, I want to say, Mark, come here. People confuse us. Okay, I frequently walk down Colfax, if you guys know, and people say, Mark, and I turn around and go, oh, it's from you, Mario. So I can understand that. So the way to tell us apart, he's got longer hair, okay? just keep that in mind, all right? So Mark Stevens writes the Allison Coyle mystery series set in the Flat Tops wilderness of western Colorado, Antler Dust, Buried by the Rhone, Trap Line, and Lake of Fire. 3 of the 4 books were finalists for the Colorado Book Award. Here we are. Trap Line won. Kirkman's Review is called Lake of Fire Irresistible. Mark is currently president of the Rocky Mountain Chapter for Mystery Writers of America and hosts the regular podcast of Rocky Mountain Fiction Writers, RMFW. He was a 2016 Rocky Mountain Fiction Writer of the Year. Take it over.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mark. That was a joke.
Yeah, I know.
Okay. Just want to recognize recognize all the fellow writers, which Josh mentioned. I'm honored to be picked tonight to read my piece from this, and especially to Dean, my co-writer, on two other stories in the book. And thanks to Josh and the whole team, Angie, what a wonderful book to hold in your hands, from my humble opinion. Okay, Burn on Wood. I'll just read the beginning. This is set in a small town in eastern Colorado. I don't give it away right away in the story, but I'll tell you tonight the main character is a preacher. And I'll just leave it at that. I don't think there are any children here. There's one little, kind of reference that might be a little R-rated, but we'll leave it at that. Okay. Burn on Wood. 9 months in this town, sure, but his messages hadn't changed. He knew what he needed to do if he was going to whip the troops into shape. He saw weakness. Weaknesses, in fact, were rampant. They festered. His work spilled out before him. He had a wistful notion that out here, out on the eastern plains, things among civilians would be different, but no. Betty Locke sat with a glass of white wine. He pictured the box in the refrigerator, a box of cheap stuff, complete with plastic spigot. He knew it was there. He didn't have to look. He glanced at his phone. 4:10 p.m. Betty Locke tried to put herself together for his visit, but it hadn't really worked. She wanted his help. She needed his help. Odd to get a request for a house call, but so what? He remained standing, a sign of urgency. For the third time in 3 weeks, her son had been disciplined for bullying. "There's nothing I can do," she said. "I need your help." He wondered how much her hair coloring cost. Gray roots, ginger coif. A big screen TV on mute played a show about buying mansions. "Expulsion is next," she said. "If there's another incident, it's automatic. Can you talk to the principal?" Betty Locke had married a melon farmer, Alfredo Perez. He lived downtown in a white clapboard two-story house. The farm was north 10 clicks out in the country. "Is Francisco here?" he said. She cocked her head to think. "I don't think so." There was a problem right there. Houses so big you don't even know who is home. Of course, if you're buzzed at this hour, what did it matter? He thought he heard rumbling upstairs. "Is he at school?" he said. "School gets out at 3:30. She looked down at her wine. "He was here for a few minutes and then ran out again, I think. Sure you won't join me? It's nearly 5. There were no strict rules about it, but he knew the impression it would leave. "Your boy took a swing." He let her chew on it. On the TV, the new mansion owners toasted with amber cocktails on a sun-splashed deck. "Just graze the kid is what he told me," she said, "and Francisco's eye is swollen. It takes two, you know. When will he be home?" The thought of trying to talk to Francisco frankly repulsed him. Francisco wouldn't listen. He was raised to ignore. He was raised to get his way. In other words, he wasn't raised. He was born and waited upon. Francisco played left tackle. His thighs were as big as dinner plates. One time he had spotted Francisco downtown, a chocolate milkshake in one hand, caramel something in the other. "Francisco keeps his own schedule," she said. "And Alfredo?" She paused, bobbed her head, squinted. "Where he's from, getting to high school is enough. Alfredo is so proud. All the football recruiters, you know? Of course Alfredo wants him to go to college. He's a junior. They drive all the way out here. 3 at the last game, 1 from Oklahoma. Hell, we may as well be Sooners down here, corner of nowhere." This is not nowhere. Hadn't they listened? He had tried to boost them up, show them he believed that everywhere mattered, everyone mattered. "You're new." "Sort of, it's true," he said. He'd heard this argument. "But I was in another town like this one, across the border in Kansas, and what?" He didn't know what he was trying to say. She stared at him, eyebrows popped high. There wasn't that feeling of being overlooked, he said. "Small town, sure, but genuine dignity, appreciation." "Jobs?" "Not much different than here, you know, a fair amount of struggling, really." "Good for them, then. Can you talk to Francisco?" They were longtime members, and this was part of the bargain, his end of it. He had a free place to stay, even with the mice and the leaky roof over the spare bedroom. He cleared his throat. "Can you excuse me?" In the bathroom, he pissed like a young stallion, loud enough that she'd know his need was real. He made a big deal out of running the water in the sink when he was done. The mirror issued a meek squeak as he pulled it open. Jackpot. Oxy front and center. He helped himself to 5, Mino 8, and half a bottle of Aleve PM, a mini ammo dump of sleep in his palm, and then into his pocket. Oxy in the right, sleep in the left. It would help him take the edge off this cranky, windblown town. He peeked in their bedroom a few steps down the long hall. The wood floor squawked. Another giant flat screen, bigger than the other. In this old house, it looked like the shiny, weird obelisk in that goofy sci-fi movie about the apes and the slow, singing computer. The bed was up as high as his waist. It was so high, Alfredo could stand on the floor while he went down on her. That is, if he wanted to. If Mexican melon farmers did those things. Maybe that's why she drank. The down comforter was a beauty, but it wouldn't fit in his pocket. He had yet to feel warm in the miserable quarters that came with his deal. They stood at the door. He saw she must need to pluck the eyebrows separate, pluck to keep the eyebrows separate. Of course I'll talk to him, he said. Thank you, she said. He has to graduate. I mean, that scholarship, it's everything.
Thank you very much. Are there questions for any part of this trio?
Any questions?
Which one is which?
I get confused. Thank you.
Thank you, three. Next, Thomas Wolfe will read from The Last Stand of the Pack, Critical Edition. Last Stand of the Park, Critical Edition, co-edited with Andrew Gulliford. Tom is the author of Ice Crusaders, Colorado Sangre de Cristo Mountains, In Fire's Way, Arthur Carhart, and La Guadalupe Pena. He has taught at Brandeis University and Colorado College and worked for the National Park Service and Wyoming Outdoor Council and the Nature Conservancy. This critical edition explores the past and future of wolves in Colorado. Originally published in 1929, The Last Stand of the Pack is a historical account of the extermination of what were then believed to be the last wolves in Colorado. In this new edition, the original text is accompanied by an extensive introduction with biographical details on Arthur Carhart and an overview of the history of wolf eradication in the West. Chapters by prominent wildlife biologists, environmentalists, wolf reintroduction activists, and ranchers. And an epilogue considering the reintroduction of wolves into Colorado. So I'll turn it over to Tom to read. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Arthur Carhart would love this event. He lived on 25th and Eudora in Park Hill, and that was where I first got to know him. But actually, I had known him earlier from the Park Hill Public Library, where all of his books were super popular in the 1950s. He was a blood and guts conservation writer. 50 years ago, he was the most important and most widely read conservation writer in America. His most famous book is this one, Last Stand of the Pack. And what it chronicles is the process of exterminating the last wolves in Colorado. It took Carhart and his co-writer, Stanley Young, 7 years to research this book. And by the time the book came out in 1929, Carhart had changed his mind. But by then, the wolves were gone. So we're left with that legacy. On the other hand, I'm here to tell you the wolves are coming back willy-nilly, whether we like it or not. Thank you. The issue is whether we manage it, and that's why we put this book together, Andy Gulliford and I. We print the original text, and then we asked prominent wildlife biologists, including people who oppose wolf reintroduction, to contribute to the anthology. I think what Carhartt would have liked about this is the profound ambivalence that we feel when we stare straight into the eyes of one of these animals. We're both major predators, and denying that is a serious emotional and philosophical mistake. So Carhartt was great, in my opinion, because he changed his mind, because he was capable of changing his mind, and then spending the rest of his life trying to make up for the mistakes he'd made when they were exterminating the wolves. Stanley Young wasn't that way at all. He kept on posing and trapping until the end of his life, and the organization he headed is today's Fish and Wildlife Service. So if you like ironies, there's a good one. I want to read first from an essay by Tom Compton, who is a neighbor of mine in southwestern Colorado. I'm from Cortez, and a rancher there. He strongly opposes wolf reintroduction, and he has the credentials to do so. He has a PhD in zoology from the University of Wyoming. He's a real live rancher. He's got grandchildren on the ground. And here's what Tom Compton has to say about wolf reintroduction. Now I'm reading from Compton's essay. Finally, he says, it is an established fact that human death as a result of interaction with wolves is a rare event. Rare means it doesn't happen very often. Rare does not mean it never happens. It would seem that placing these predators in closer association with humans might well increase the probability of this rare event occurring. Even without the tragedy of human death, an increase in human-wolf interactions will cause society's tolerance to wear thin. Especially in the towns and villages of western Colorado, where increasing populations of deer, bears, and mountain lion already cause a great deal of concern. Of course, those of us on the front lines dealing with wolves on a day-to-day basis would be at a higher risk. It makes me nervous to consider placing my grandchildren in a situation such as this. Ranching families are already familiar with the management adjustments necessary to successfully deal with predators. Adding the wolf to this mix may be a bit too much to ask. Well, is it or isn't it? So you be the judges. I now want to turn from Tom Compton's essay to some of Carhartt's description of how they killed the last wolves in Colorado. The answers are pretty clear in terms of the means. They shot them, they trapped them, they poisoned them. It was as simple as that. But in the process of researching this, Carhartt got to know the wolfers. And the wolfers were the men who did the poisoning, the shooting and the trapping. And the more the wolfers wolfed, the more the wolfers came to, guess what, you can figure it out, respect and even love the wolves. Okay? This is the kind of Shakespearean proportion that goes with this kind of a subject. And it's why the issue of wolf reintroduction is a lot more than just about biology. So Big Bill Cawood was one of the wolfers. He was the best of all of them, a legend in his time. And this is a section from one of the stories about killing the wolves. Big Bill has been out on the road looking for this wolf called Rags, and he's poisoned everything within 50 miles, but he can't seem to get Rags. And so he starts trapping and poisoning, and finally they come face to face. And this is the moment where Carhartt begins to feel that there's something wrong with this program, that maybe there's something, some relationship between us and the wolves that maybe should say to us, we should rethink this question. So he writes, he's finally found the wolf, he's trapped the wolf. The wolf has steel traps on two of its legs, and they're in a face-off. Okay, you recognize this. This is Western 101. Okay, they're in a face-off, and they lock eyes. 75 yards away, Rags had turned. His measured steps had not retraced more than 25 feet of that distance. He was still coming in that unhurried, slow walk, so deadly, so like an inevitable nemesis bearing down on the hunter. Queer fear leaped through Cameron's heart. There was no real chance to fight. Will's crippled leg would never permit him to climb up the steep side of the arroyo. Hampered as he was by this track, Rags would lash a man to shreds in one driving attack. One snap, and the leg would go helpless. A snip, and blood would spurt from severed veins. Then the end. But still there was that 30-foot space between Kaywood and the old lone logo. A strange new vision came flashing fleetingly to Kaywood. A vision of a lonely, heart-hungry, old wolf, without mate, yearning for some fondling touch, perhaps the kindly caress of his arch-enemy, the trapper. A vision was stalking down that trail toward him. Something tremendous, indefinable about Rags caught his attention and held it for the flash of a great understanding. Could Rags have acknowledged his defeat? Was the old wolf coming to the hunter because he knew that Caleb was his master? Was heart hurt and loneliness driving Rags to stake his life while seeking the friendship of the outdoor soul that lived in Big Bill Kaywood? There was no growling, only a great, deep, low rumbling in Rags' throat. His hair bristled, but it bristled as it might on the back of a dog. Also shy, beaten, crawling back to the feet of its master after it had done something wrong and by fawning sought forgiveness. And yet there was regal bearing in Rags of Cathedral which declared his kingship of his kind. Fascinated, Caleb gazed at the wolf. Slowly, ever so slowly, those padding steps were coming nearer. The flash of fang in the big mouth caught Caleb's eye. The spell broke. Nervous fingers again touched the gun hammer, but the trigger was jammed. The horse snorted, began to back down the trail. The 30-foot space was 20. Again, Bill tugged at the trigger. For what seemed to him the 100th time, the hammer would not hold, would not click, would not catch. 15 feet away, the wolf still came toward Kaywood in that march of death or life. The hunter felt a sweat break out on his body. He wondered if he would have the steady nerve to plant a sure bullet if the hammer would catch. He tugged vainly. Then a new thought came. He would let the hammer slip under his thumb. It would explode the shell, send the bullet whining at the stalking wolf. 10, with traps clanking, the determined, unhurried wolf was coming. For what? Forgiveness, company, sympathy, release, recognizing Big Bill Kaywood, wolfer, outdoors man, kindred spirit as his master? Could he be coming seeking release from the trap, sympathy for the injured paw? Or was it murder, revenge, the final summation of the hate he had held for years against man? Was there bloodlust in that wolf heart, deep boiling spirit of revenge against the man who had trapped him, deprived him of liberty? The flash of fang, those steady eyes, that clanking, unhurried tread. With all his understanding of the wild and its inhabitants, Kaywood could not tell whether Rags came seeking friendship or was stalking along that trail intent on killing. Not an instant remained to speculate, to try to analyze the emotion tumbling through the heart of Rags. Bill Kaywood yanked as he had not before, at the hammer on the 25-35. It clicked, held, up came the gun, snapshots were taken. Bill's finger pressed while his arm steadied. 8 feet, just 8 feet between Rags and the man who had mastered him. A snap, quick, sharp, spinning death. The bullet had but scant distance to go. Quivering, struggling, still to come on, Rags slumped in the trail, a bullet through his heart. For a moment, Bill Kaywood stood on the trail, staring down on the jerking body of the great lobo wolf. One instant, there whipped through him keen, agonizing regret. The next, he was thanking his lucky stars that the bit of the splinter from the stock of the gun had not held the trigger from catching when he made the last frantic pull. Life flickered feebly in Rags. The lonely killer looked up at the man in front of him. The horse, swinging his head from side to side, snorted, moved uneasily. In the last shaky effort, the great gray form raised itself, encumbered by the gripping tentacles of death, weighted with the traps of steel, and tried with the last flow of strength before his life finally slipped away to reach the feet of the Wolfer Kaywood, his master. Almost with his curving nose touching Kaywood's boot, he fell, quivered, stiffened. "You poor old devil," cried Bill huskily as he stooped impulsively. "You poor, old, lonely, murdering devil."
Other
questions for Tom?
Just curious, what you have done for your guys writing or anthologizing?
The question is, what have you done besides writing and anthologizing? And I worked for the Nature Conservancy in Wyoming, and we were interested in rare plants in the greater Yellowstone ecosystem. One of them was Agrostis lossii, named after the first female botanist to cover that territory. It grew only around the hot pots in Yellowstone. And the problem was, the elk and the deer had that figured out, and the bison, and they spent all their time around the hot pots eating one of the world's rarest plants. It's now used in research for what might grow on Mars. So this is one of the first steps in bringing the wolf back to Yellowstone. We had to convince the Park Service that those big animals needed to move, the elk and the bison. And there was nothing to move them. And so the beginning of building the case for the biology of moving the elk and the deer and the bison was bringing the wolf back, because that's what moves them. And that was the beginning of a great saga of wolf reintroduction in Yellowstone that is proving successful. Now what we want to do is have the whole Southern Rockies ecosystem linked back up together with wolves coming down from Wyoming. They're doing it already. We want to do it in a genetically sound way and in a wildlife management sound way. We think we have the science behind what we want to do, but this won't come down to science, will it? It comes down to emotion of the kind that was in Carhartt's writing and that was in Tom Compton's writing. When Tom Compton makes his case against wolf reintroduction, it's about the wolf slaughtering his grandchildren. And there's not a number or a statistic in it. He's appealing to your emotions and to your fear of wolves. That's a real fear. They are big, fierce animals. And so are we. I hope that begins to answer your question. And by the way, we saved the damn planet. And I mentioned the Mars business because you never know when those little critters prove of interest. And in fact, if you can survive around the hot pots, you may survive on Mars. So, thank you for the question.
Thank you.
Next, we have a finalist in the creative nonfiction category, Finn Murphy. He'll read from his memoir, The Long Haul, A Trucker's Tale of Life on the Road. Finn grew up in Connecticut and now lives in Colorado. He started working as a long-haul trucker in 1980, and this is his first book. More than 30 years ago, he dropped out of college to become a long-haul trucker. Since then, he's covered more than a million miles, packing, loading, and hauling people's belongings all over America. He spends his days and many of his nights in a 53-foot, 18-wheeler he calls Cassidy. In The Long Haul, he offers a trucker-eye view of America on the move. As he crisscrossed the country, Murphy recounts the wit, candor, and charm, the America he has seen change over the decades, from the hollowing out of small towns to changing tastes in the culture and home furnishings. Finn, you're off.
now for something completely different. I'm not sure I'm going to read from my book, because I think I need to give you all a reason to read my book. Truckers, who cares? Got an opinion? Got a stereotype? Good. That's what this is about. Thank you.
You carried my art stuff.
Did I break it?
Yes.
Oh, sorry. Yes, movers, I know. So I thought it was high time there was some reasonably literate treatment about truck drivers. Hasn't every American looked up at a truck when you passed it on the highway, wondered what that life might be like? Most of us have. I suppose all trucks look interchangeable. Maybe you think all truck drivers do the same kind of work. But neither of those things is true. There's a strict hierarchy among drivers depending on what you drive, what you haul, and how you get paid. So I'm a mover. I work for a van line. I'm called a bedbugger in the community or the fraternity that looks down on us. Flatbed haulers are called skateboarders. Double trailers are called widow wagons. Natural gas haulers are called suicide jockeys. Lumber trucks are called toothpicks. Live animal haulers are called chicken chokers. There's a whole other slang for people that don't drive trucks. Most of you folks out there are four-wheelers. An ambulance is a boombox. A school bus is a cheese wagon. And a motorcycle rider is called an organ donor. Like any specialized vocabulary, the whole point here is to magnify separation. So my book, The Long Haul, it's also about work. It's about how manual work can be a choice-worthy occupation. It's about how manual labor has been devalued over time. And it's about how satisfying and tribal and elemental it can be to work with a group of men doing very difficult physical labor. My book's also about what I've seen going on in America over the last 40 years as a long-haul driver, which I still am. I had a job in Erie, actually, this morning. My choice of work has given me a unique perspective. I don't drive a dark line from terminal to terminal like other kinds of truck drivers. As a mover, I go into towns, I go into communities, and I get to deal on a very intimate level with the people who are working on a transition to a new home. 41 million Americans move every year, 1 out of 7. That's a mind-boggling number. Very few of those 40 million have any idea what they're getting into, and not a single one of those 41 million knows the kind of person to whom they're relinquishing all their worldly goods or your artwork. Careful people, people who lock their doors, people who carry umbrellas, people who change their garage door codes, daily and routinely consign everything they own over to the movers. I find that very odd. While moving is a near universal American experience, the moving industry is completely opaque. Movers are like morticians and lawyers. Hiring one indicates an irrevocable step that carries a good deal of emotional baggage. Often our entry on the scene isn't good news. Children's lives are disrupted. An extended family might be separated. A husband or a wife's status as an earner might be threatened. People are always asking me, what is the magic piece of advice I can give to make moving easier? And my answer is the one thing that nobody will do, which is get rid of everything you own and pack a suitcase. I've also been truthful in my book about what I've seen out there on what we call the big slab. I've watched a good part of the Midwest become denuded of people. If there is such a thing as the American heartland, it has a stake through it. There's nothing out there now but meatpacking plants set far away from prying eyes. A corn monoculture where I can drive 100 miles and not see a human being or human habitation. I've seen the death flurries of hundreds of small towns in the face of big boxes that have destroyed once thriving commercial centers. I've seen self-serving land use transform huge swaths of this nation into auto-dependent, low-density housing. But this book is not a dystopian screed. It's actually funny and breezy most of the time. We'll spend some time with Tommy Mahoney, my Florida helper. He carries around a thermos bottle with vodka and orange juice. Vodka and, what's a Cape Codder? Vodka and cranberry juice. He carries that around like a triathlete carries around a water bottle. We'll meet the genial Bangladeshi doctor who moves to Utah to become a cowboy. And we'll meet Mrs. Foster, who can't bring herself to throw anything away. I've performed over 3,000 moves. I know things. I know that in 30 minutes I'm going to know you better than your best friends do after 30 years. I know the things you want to keep hidden. Now, I don't get any voyeuristic pleasure from this. Actually, occasionally I do get that. I also know that everyone has almost the exact same stuff. And I certainly know where it's going to end up. In a yard sale or in a dumpster. It might take a generation, though usually not that long, but Aunt Tilly's antique vanity, it's getting tossed. So is your high school yearbook. So are the kids' drawings taped to the refrigerator. Maybe you can't bring yourselves to throw your stuff away, but your descendants will have no such qualms. This is not anecdotal. I'm the guy who's hired to take care of this stuff. All movers, even if they don't know it, are Buddhists. We understand the transitory nature of people's stuff. But here's the thing. The fact that everything you've accumulated throughout your lifetime is getting thrown away isn't sad, and it's not tragic. It's actually a chance to focus on what's important. It's not the stuff that matters. It's the connection with people and family and friends and community that matter. And many of the people I move get this backwards. Let's talk a little bit about truckers. My CV handle, by the way, is U-Turn, because I'm routinely putting my big truck into places where trucks aren't supposed to go. Trucking is enshrouded in American myths, and they don't have that much to do with the work I do or the work other truck drivers do. Though it's very true, everybody wants to pull the air horn. My labor pool is a multicultural mix of workers who reside at the bottom end of the American dream. My fellow truckers are, maybe surprisingly, not a harmonized phalanx of redneck simians. In the long haul, I attempt to unpeel the onion of myths so that maybe we can get to a larger and better truth. One truth is the ocean of disorientation and fear that a long-haul driver swims in. The fear seems to surprise people. It's not something drivers talk about. And I'm afraid of rain and snow and ice and mountains and brake lights. Another truth is that it can be very rewarding to see places most people never see. And it's very useful to observe human beings in a setting where they believe themselves to be unseen. Their cars. What makes people in cars act as if they're invisible? There's windows all around. There's a license plate where you can be identified. I'm way up high in my truck, and I can see everything you folks are doing in your cars. And people do a lot of things in their cars. So I invite you to read my book and come on. Let's take a little ride. Thank you. You got a tame truck driver here. There must be something that's been sitting in your heads for like 10 years, right? No? Sir.
You've been moving stuff for quite a long time. Any changes in the character of what people drink with them or what's being moved that's worth commenting on, or is it all pretty much the same old stuff but a little shinier?
Huge, that's a great question. Huge differences. For one thing, houses are 30% bigger than they were in 1984, but there's less stuff in them. Books are completely disappearing from American households in the middle and upper middle class, which is who I work with. Antiques are disappearing. Silver sets are disappearing. The 12-piece china set you got for your wedding has disappeared. Good furniture has disappeared. It's IKEA and Disney videos and bigger houses. And the three-car garage, by the way, is not, in my opinion, an architectural accent. Yes.
So I imagine you have a lot of time while you're driving. Have you been composing this book for a few years in your head? Have you been recording yourself while you're driving as you're having these thoughts?
Yes, yeah, how the book started. So I was recording myself. That's exactly what I did at the end of the day to unwind. And then I started recording myself while I was driving. And then I started recording my interactions with my crews. And then I started recording my interactions surreptitiously, illegally, and unethically with the people that I was moving. And that's what formed the spine of the book. Thank you. Sir.
So there was a time in, I believe, the early 1970s when we kind of had some romantic media about truckers, you know, the song Convoy, and there was, I believe, a television show that featured a pair of long-distance truckers and a Burt Reynolds movie that featured truckers. Can you speak to kind of the mythology of truckers and maybe puncture some of the myths that we were put back then?
Yes, so there was a cultural sort of mass going on at the time, right? And Burt Reynolds actually, I think, had three movies. Clint Eastwood had a movie. Convoy was a movie with Ally McGraw and Chris Christopherson. I think it's one. It has a rating 1 on Rotten Tomatoes. I think that was an attempt to mythologize and romanticize a job that is basically unromanticizable. I don't think that's quite a word. I think it couldn't get the sort of cultural momentum because it's a tough job, it's a dead-end job, it's for most people it's a very low-paying job. And I think what people wanted to do in 76, 77 was, you know, find something there that was, you know, that they could latch onto as a cultural ethos and couldn't quite pull it off. But there's more about that in the book. Sir.
You mentioned a number of machines that you fear while you're driving down the road. On Tuesday, when I was going home, I left Fort Collins, driving from Denver. Five trucks blown over on their side, mangled, just between Denver and Fort Collins. Have you ever experienced anything like that in Scary Wind?
Two things. Actually, I was going to read from the introduction today and decided not to, but right in the introduction I saw a truck blown over on I-80 in Wyoming. My truck was parked in Erie when a mini tornado came through just a couple years ago. It was empty and it blew right over on its side. And then I had to pay $2,000 for three tow trucks to come and put it back on its feet, and of course it was all destroyed. Yes, sir.
Do you see many women and truck drivers, and are you worried about driverless cars?
So, do I see women and driverless cars? The whole truck stop scene has gotten a whole lot better in the last 10 or 15 years because there's more women. You have a lot of husband and wife teams now that are coming into the industry, and that's really helped a lot. I think men behave a lot better at truck stops when there's women around. So here's an interesting thing about statistics. So I could put this two ways. I could say that the number of women in truck driving has doubled in the last 2 years, or I could say it's only 7% of drivers. So there are more women now. And as far as autonomous vehicles go, 3 to 5 years for big trucks. We've already logged 22 million miles with autonomous trucks in the United States. They're all over Nevada. They're all over Pennsylvania. They were all over Arizona until a couple of weeks ago with the Uber crash. This is not only coming, it's here. So that's that. Yes, sir.
Steve got a nice comment. Ted Conover on the back about the guy who wrote Loser Man, which is a great book, and included an update about his experiences following truck drivers in Africa. I'm just wondering if the United States is considered a good place to be a trucker, if there are better countries in terms of safety and drunk driving issues, how the highways are built, everything else. Obviously, there are a lot worse places.
Yes, well, Nigeria is definitely the worst place. They have to sleep under their wheels so that nobody steals the tires. I mean, it's crazy. I guess it's not a bad place to be a truck driver, America, but frankly, it's not going to matter much because, as I say, in 3 to 5 years, there's not going to be any long-haul drivers. So that's kind of the way I look at it. You got 7 or 8 or 9 of the most aggressive capitalized companies in the entire planet, all in a space race for autonomous vehicles. It's going to happen.
You're going to have to read Finn's book.
Oh, boy, I love all these questions. Thank you.
4 years ago, we made a long-haul move out here from the East Coast. Relinquished all our worldly possessions, and for I think it was close to 2 weeks, had no idea where it was. My question to you is, where were you to tell us to just pack a suitcase, get in there?
I'm sorry, I'm not sure. Was I on that move? Was it, did you say 40 years ago or 4? Oh, 4. Well, I was there 40 years ago, too. I looked a little different. Yes, in the back.
Is this a first book for you, and what's next for you?
This is a first book for me, and this is a real Cinderella story. I mean, I was reviewed in the New Yorker, the New York Times, the Denver Post, or the poor Denver Post. Jason Blevins, by the way, if anybody knows Jason from the Denver Post, he was one of the 20 people that were let go a couple of weeks ago. That's a very sad thing. I was reviewed everywhere really positively, and I was on Fresh Air with Terry Gross. I got a little crush on her, and I found out that the crush is mutual. Now that's pretty cool. So it's my first book. I might write another book on something else. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I think I'm way out of time. Ms. Burton? Air ride trailer and tractor. I've got a Freightliner Cascadia. Picked it up in November. It had 42 miles on it.
All right.
Brand new. All right. Thank you all very much.
Well, the other finalists in the creative nonfiction category could not be here tonight, unfortunately. Eric Weinmeier, whose book, No Barriers, is unable to be here, and I don't believe he's going to be able to read it another one. Helen Thorpe, another nominee, will be reading on May 4th, and Camille Dungy will be reading on April 27th. So those are the other people if you're interested in that particular category. Our guest from the history category is David Barron. He'll be reading from his book, American Eclipse, a nation's epic race to catch the shadow of the moon and win the glory of the world. David, an award-winning journalist and author of Beasts in the Garden, is a former science correspondent for NPR, former science editor for the public radio program The World, and David has a passion for chasing eclipses, which began back in 1998. He lives in Boulder. On a scorching July afternoon in 1878, at the dawn of the Gilded Age, the moon's shadow descended on the American West, darkening skies from Montana Territory to Texas. This rare celestial event, a total solar eclipse, offered a priceless opportunity to solve some of the solar system's most enduring riddles, and it prompted a clutch of enterprising scientists to brave the frontier in a grueling race to get to the Rocky Mountains. David recreates this epic tale of ambition, failure, and glory in a narrative that reveals as much about the historical trajectory of the striving young nation as it does about those scant 3 minutes when the blue sky darkened and stars appeared in mid-afternoon. David. Yeah.
Thank you. I think I'll have to lower this a little bit. So how many of you actually saw the total solar eclipse last August? So the total one, like up in Wyoming or Nebraska. So those those of you who missed it, April 8, 2024 will be the next total eclipse in the United States. Go see it. You really must at least once in your life have the experience. This was my sixth total solar eclipse. I'm an eclipse junkie, which led me to write the book. And I'm really tickled to have been nominated in the history category because I'm really a science writer. But this book really is as much a work of history as it is a work of science. And so as you heard, it tells the true story of a total solar eclipse that crossed the Wild West on July 29, 1878. And as crazy as the United States was about the eclipse last summer, it was the same in 1878. People knew it was coming. Tourists came out. And in 1878, total eclipses were really important to science because astronomers would use total eclipses as a rare opportunity to do studies of the sun, and particularly the sun's outer atmosphere, that they could only study for about 3 minutes once every 18 months somewhere on the planet, usually someplace very hard to get to. And when a total solar eclipse was coming to America's backyard, that was America's chance to show the world what it could do in science. So it's a story about a country that was just maturing intellectually and about several individuals who came out to the West with something to prove. The person you all have heard of who came here in 1878 was Thomas Edison, who went to Wyoming he had invented a device specifically for studying the solar eclipse. But my favorite character, and I'll read a short section about that character, is someone who came out to the West, who actually came to Denver with a very different purpose in mind. And her name was Maria Mitchell. Maria Mitchell was by far the most famous female scientist in America in the 19th century. She was an astronomer. She came to fame when living on Nantucket. She discovered a comet, the first person in the world, and got a gold medal from the King of Denmark. By 1878, she was teaching astronomy at Vassar College, the relatively new all-women's college in Poughkeepsie, New York. And as you can imagine, it was not easy being a female scientist in America in 1878. And so let me just read a short section about Maria Mitchell and what her background was. And again, I want to give kind of a sense of the history aspect of the book, because a lot of it really is history. And so this is what I write about Maria Mitchell. Despite teaching at a women's college, she received less than half the salary paid to the school's male professors, an injustice she fought with some success. And while astronomers at other universities were offered generous faculty housing, Mitchell occupied the sparest of accommodations. For her first decade at Vassar, she slept on a sofa in the corner of a box-like space that alternately served as parlor and lecture room. When the college finally provided her with a separate apartment for sleeping, it had previously been the observatory's coal storeroom, one of her students marked the occasion in tongue-in-cheek verse. "Beautiful Venus, pride of the morning, tell it to all little stars who have fled. And in a sweet chamber that needs no adorning, Miss Mitchell sleeps in bed." Despite her clashes with the college administration, Mitchell loved her girls, as she called her students, and in turn they adored her. It was for them that she took up arms in the fight for women's higher education, a campaign she waged even as a storm of opposition billowed. In 1873, a year when the nation was grappling with financial panic, a prominent Boston physician introduced a new cause for public alarm. In an incendiary book called Sex in Education, or A Fair Chance for the Girls, Dr. Edward H. Clarke warned that the push for female colleges and co-education could seriously undermine the health of American women. He contended that by taxing the brain, higher education caused a girl's body, especially her reproductive organs, to atrophy. When arrested development of the reproductive system is nearly or quite complete, it produces a change in a woman's character, he wrote. And this included, quote, a dropping out of maternal instincts and an appearance of Amazonian coarseness and force. Such persons, he continued, are analogous to the sexless class of termites. Clark recounted case studies of previously healthy girls who, after studying at Vassar and other schools, became pale, sterile invalids. In one instance, he diagnosed death from overwork, and a new term, Vassar victims, entered the late 19th century lexicon. Thrown on the defensive, proponents of women's education published a barrage of rebuttals, offering evidence of the health of college girls and stressing the benefits of higher learning. If we know the number of young girls who have died from overstudy, let us find the number who have died from aimless lives and the number who have lived on and ceased to be young, said the redoubtable Moriah Mitchell. Clark's critics called out his book for what it was, a thin, hysterical polemic based on conjecture and scanty evidence. Earl Madden, Sex in Education found a receptive audience in an America unsettled by shifting gender roles. The Civil War, having tragically killed well over 500,000 men, left many women unmarried, forcing them to enter the workforce. Meanwhile, the successful effort to abolish slavery had inspired women to seek their own full citizenship, including the right to vote, which was no longer denied, at least in theory, to free black men. American society was changing so irrevocably that it seemed women were in danger of no longer being women, and men would soon be emasculated and cease to be men. Clark's book foretold this horrid future. And so, in 1878, when the eclipse was coming, and dozens of astronomers from Yale and Princeton and the University of Michigan and Johns Hopkins made plans to come out to the Wild West on these expeditions that took a lot of money and months to prepare for and weeks of hard travel. And they were getting enthusiastic support and financial backing from the federal government. Mariah Mitchell, who was left out of it all, decided to, on her own, put together an all-female eclipse expedition to Denver, Colorado. And she came out here and got tremendous attention from the press. And it was more than a scientific expedition. It really was a bit of political theater. It was Mariah Mitchell's attempt to show the country that despite what Dr. Clark had written and gotten so much attention for, women could be educated and smart and scientifically minded and healthy and feminine to boot. And so I love her story, but it's just one of many amazing stories of the people who came out to the American West in 1878. Now, one brief final section. Ultimately, it is a story, of course, about an eclipse. And I am an eclipse chaser, an eclipse is a total solar eclipse is unlike anything else. And so the book really leads up to the climax of that moment when finally the moon which is passing in front of the sun in the middle of the day, blocks out the direct sunlight, and suddenly people are cast into shadow. And I'll just read one paragraph at the moment that the total solar eclipse begins. A total eclipse is a primal, transcendent experience. The shutting off of the sun does not bring utter darkness. It is more like falling through a trap door into a dimly lit, unrecognizable reality. The sky is not the sky of the earth, neither the star-filled dome of night nor the immersive blue of daylight, but an ashen ceiling of slate. A few bright stars and planets shine familiarly like memories from a distant childhood, but the most prominent object is thoroughly foreign. You may know intellectually that it is both the sun and moon, yet it looks like neither. It is an ebony pupil surrounded by a pearly iris. It is the eye of the cosmos. Thank you.
Questions? Anyone have questions?
Where did you go to Wyoming? What was the primo spot for you? You would know, and I want to be there the next time.
So where I had, so I made my hotel reservations 3 years in advance. Seriously, in Jackson. And if I could, I'll get to the answer to your question in a minute, but if I could have been anywhere in 1878, in hindsight, it would have been on top of Pike's Peak. And there were folks on top of Pike's Peak, and I write about the people who were up there, because what they saw was absolutely astonishing. From 14,000 feet up, not only were they able, but they were able to look up to the northwest and see the moon's shadow as this black curtain racing toward them at 2,000 miles an hour, swallowing everything as it came forward. And being so high up, they really saw the sun's corona exceptionally clearly. So I wanted to be on a mountaintop. And so I was on top of Rendezvous Peak at the ski resort at Teton Village. They had announced a year in advance that they were going to sell tram tickets for Eclipse Day on a certain Monday in September of 2016. This is for August 2017. And within 15 minutes, all the tickets were sold, but I grabbed them. So I was on top of Rendezvous Peak. And it was breathtaking. And so the next total solar eclipse in the U.S. will be in 2024, but there will be one next July of 2019 in South America. So I will be in the Andes for that one.
So 10 years in advance.
In 2024? Well, in 2024, and that will be an even better eclipse than this one, this last year. The path of totality goes from Texas to Maine, and really you want to be on the Texas part of it because the odds of clear skies will be better, and it will last longer. You may recall the one in August of last year lasted for 2.5 minutes, which is about typical. The one in 2024 will last as much as 4.5 minutes in Texas. By the time it gets to Maine, it's 3.5 minutes. So I will be somewhere in Texas, probably staying mobile, so at the last minute I can dash to wherever the skies are clear.
So we talked about this for a long time. Brendan and I are friends. We were both working on our books, and this was kind of a secret mission for a while. And I'm kind of curious, as you're an eclipse chaser and somebody who's very passionate about them, how did you come up with the idea for the book? When and which eclipse or what moment did you come up with this idea for this particular idea of this eclipse?
So yeah, well, Michael, who's a friend, was asking about how I came up with the idea. Just so to say, I mean, this book was 19 years in the making because I saw my first total eclipse in 1998. And got the idea that I wanted to write an eclipse book, but knew I shouldn't. There's no point in having it come out before the August of 2017 because that's when people would care about it. So it was about 7 years ago I got serious about figuring out what the book would be, and I was just looking for a really good story. And it really started with Thomas Edison when I learned that Thomas Edison was in the Wild West in 1878, right after he invented the phonograph and right before he invented the electric light bulb. when I found out about his adventures, I thought there's got to be a book in there. And then when I found out about all the other amazing characters and what this event meant for the maturation of the United States, it all came together.
Is there an amazing story that didn't make it in, or a particular
site? No, there were lots of other great stories, and actually one of them may be in my next book. So,
don't give away the secret.
Yeah, so thank you all.
Well, we should thank the Book Bar for hosting this reading series, and thanks to the Colorado Book Awards entrance judges, selectors, volunteers, to Colorado Humanities and Center for the Book staff. Special thanks to the Colorado Book Award program coordinator, Bess, who produces all the readings, facilitates adjudications, and stages the ceremony. And we hope everyone will come to the C Film Center on June 2nd when the awards are given out to the winners in every category, 4:30 in the afternoon. And you can go to coloradohumanities.org to find out details. But before we break up, we want to bring all the finalists up for a photo. And then there'll be an opportunity for anyone who wants to ask any further questions to do so, and then to get signatures on books if you're buying the book. So please, authors,